And we're going to be in Ephesians. We're going to continue in our journey in Ephesians. So if you'd like to have a Bible there, which we really always recommend, it's on, if you're using one of these churches' Bibles, it's on page 1176. That's page 1176. And it's Ephesians chapter 5. And we're in the paragraph, sentence 7 through to sentence 14, and I'll read it as we progress through it this morning. Now, if you've been a Christian, and being a Christian simply means trusting Jesus, that's all really being a Christian means. It means that you've learnt that Jesus is more trustworthy than anything else, and you're relying upon him. If you've been a Christian any length of time, or if you've been familiar with the Bible, or you've heard the Bible taught in church, or you try and read it yourself, if you've been any significant time doing any of those things, there are probably verses or stories or sections of the Bible which really mean something to you personally. For whatever reason, they're laden with history and significance. It might not be all of our experiences, don't worry if it's not yours, but many of us would say there are certain parts of the Bible which at points in my life have really spoken to me or been really relevant. And Ephesians chapter 5, sentence 14, which is probably the chorus of an ancient hymn, is one of those for me. Wake up, O sleeper, rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. The reason being, about 10 years ago or so, a lady who is still and was very dear to Hannah and I, we love her very much, and her family that she's got now, and her daughter that she's got now, about 10 years ago, she got baptized. She decided to make that public declaration of her faith in Jesus. And she had grown up in a Christian family, a really great, wonderful Christian family. She'd grown up in that Christian family. They presented Jesus to her. But for whatever reason, during her late teens and early 20s, that faith had just lain dormant. It was there. It was present. She never denied that she was a Christian. But it just didn't function in her life. It just wasn't a priority. It was asleep. It was dormant. It was like the dog curled up at the fireside. It's there, but it's pretty irrelevant. That was her faith. And then as she came to the end of her nurse training at Nottingham University, 24, 25 years old, for a whole number of reasons, she awoke that faith. And she stood up in front of her church there in South Nottingham, full of people the room was, some who loved her really dearly. We'd gathered. We weren't part of the church there in Nottingham. We'd come to join her for a baptism. Some of them who didn't know her at all, because it was a reasonably big church and she was a transient student. Some were Christians, some weren't Christians. A group just like us, she stood up and she said, "This is what has happened to me. Wake up, O sleeper, and rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you." And so, because of how dearly Hannah and I hold that lady, chapter 5, verse 14 is one of those verses for me that is laden with real meaning and real sentiment. Wake up, O sleeper, rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. Wake up, O sleeper, rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. See, the reality of what Paul, who wrote this letter, has been saying is that Christians, those who trust Jesus, either as individuals or together as a corporate body, are called to a radical, prevailing, all-encompassing, costly mission. We are called to represent God in every nook and cranny of our lives. Back in chapter 3, sentence 10, he describes it like this. He says, God's intent, this is chapter 3, verse 10, God's intent was that now, through the church, the individual members and the corporate body, through the church, the manifold wisdom of God should be made known. That as we trust in Jesus, we're called into this amazing reality that we are to put God on display. We're to put the manifold, which means multifaceted or multicolored wisdom of God on display in our lives. That through our relationships, through our generosity, through our righteous anger when we see injustice and the pursuit of eradicating that injustice, through our kindness, through how we take our strength, which we'll all have intellectually or physically or emotionally or financially, but we use that strength to serve and benefit others, through making ourselves as productive as we possibly can with the gifts that God has given us, through our hospitality, Hospitality literally means the welcoming of strangers. Through how we welcome and embrace everyone. Through our level of sophistication as we think through the complex realities of life. That in every single way we are called to put the many faceted wisdom of God on display. As parents to our children, as partners to those that we love. In the workplace, through our careers, in our leisure time, as we do Pilates, as a citizen. We're to show what God is like. And there is no richer or fuller or greater reality that a human being can experience than to live out the very thing we are created for, which is to image what God is like, to put God on display, as Paul said back there in chapter 3, to put the manifold wisdom of God on display. John Piper, who is one of my favorite pastors and theologians and poets and authors, probably most famously has said, God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him. But you can flip that round the other way and come to the realization that we are most satisfied in life when God is most glorified in us. The more we fulfill this all-encompassing mission of putting God on display, the more satisfying, the more purposeful, the more significant we will actually find our lives are, particularly when we look back from the hindsight of eternity and see how we spent the 6 seconds that God gave us to live on this world, which is what, 4 score years, 3 score years and 10. Is that what they say? That's what it will seem like, 6 seconds. How did I use those 6 seconds? But the reality, having had that incredible calling placed upon us, and if you're not yet a Christian, ponder the awesomeness of what God calls you to be when you trust Jesus to show what he is like. The reality is, we tend to fall asleep. We tend to slumber and doze and miss it. When I was 16, I'd just finished my GCSEs and was going to go in to do A-levels at college, at sixth form. And you get that very long summer break, don't you? And my mum and dad were desperate not to have a stinky teenager laying on the sofa for 3 months. And so they kicked me out to do all various kind of enterprises and things, and my favourite of which was six weeks hay baling on a farm. But one of the things they sent me to do, because I was interested in becoming a doctor, a medical doctor at that time, was to go spend 4 days at university, also happened to be in Nottingham, at university, sitting in the lectures and classes of medical students that were still studying. So I was thrilled about this. I thought this would be great, 4 days at university when you're 16 years old, which your mum and dad have signed off on. I mean, does that get any better, really? So I got on the train at Milton Keynes to go up and across to Nottingham. But because GCSEs had finished about a week before, there had been some celebrations taking place with my mates and classmates. And so it was fair to say that I was feeling a little bit peaky and slightly tired as I got on that train at Milton Keynes. And I promptly dozed off. I have no idea, I can't remember where I woke up, but it was well north of Nottingham. And had great adventure as a 16-year-old who clearly wouldn't have done things like take a bit of extra cash with him or something sensible like that. And yes, I'm old enough that this was pre-mobile phones and those sorts of things. It took me the best part of the day to find myself back to Nottingham. I dozed off and missed a great experience. Spiritually, we do the same. We've been called to this great reality to put the manifold wisdom of God on display through being a parent, a social worker, a friend, a citizen, a gym partner, a jogging pal. We're called to do this amazing thing. God's intent is that now, through the church, individually and corporately, the manifold wisdom of God would be put on display. You're his showcase. And yet, if you're like me, we fall asleep, we slumber, and we doze. Wake up, O sleeper, and rise from the dead. And Christ will shine on you. Perhaps you've dozed off because you think your part is too minimal. what impact could you possibly make? Perhaps you've dozed off because you think the effort is too great and there's easier rewards found elsewhere. Perhaps you've dozed off because you feel God is too distant and you've not had the kind of experiences that the church sometimes unhelpfully telegraphs as normal Christianity when they're not. Perhaps you simply think success is too unlikely in your life. Maybe because of some habitual or what you think is prevailing sin that you fought but never defeated. Perhaps you just think the rewards are too intangible and you would rather have the fast car you can drive today. But you've dozed off. Maybe not in all of your life, but perhaps in an element of your life. In that sense, it's like spiritual chloroform, isn't it? A little bit of it lays us unconscious. A lot of it, and it kills us spiritually. And so Paul says, "Wake up, O sleeper, and rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you." That's toddler speak for preach it, brother, if you're wondering. And do you see what it carries on and says? And I can't help but picture that really great friend of ours as she stood up, having had the experience I've just recounted of 8 or 10 years where her faith had lain dormant, present but asleep. And she stood up and she said, "I've shaken myself awake. I've enlivened my faith." And then do you see what it says? It says, then what? Christ will shine on you. Now, what does it mean, we need to ask ourselves, when it says that Christ will shine on you? Well, if you shut your Bible because of that elongated introduction, open it back up again and look back at sentence 13 here in chapter 5. Because what it means that Christ will shine on us is articulated right here. Chapter 5, sentence 13. It says, "But everything exposed by the light of Christ, becomes visible, and everything that is illuminated becomes a light." Now, there's a paradox that's very interesting there, isn't there? The first half of the sentence is pretty painful. The second half of the sentence is pretty purposeful. It's like the proverbial surgeon's knife that heals so that it might harm. The painful thing when Christ's light shines on us is that everything exposed by the light becomes visible. Now, that is painful. And some of us, all of us, I think, who probably are genuinely trusting Jesus, will say there are times, perhaps when I first trusted him or as he's journeyed with me, when his light has shone into my life and exposed things that I am deeply ashamed were there to be found. It's like that mother of a teenager on a bright spring morning flings open the curtains to reveal the full horror of her lad's bedroom. Even worse, to his great shame, she lifts up the mattress and shows what's under there. When Christ's light shines on us, it is painful for every and all of us because there are things that we really don't want exposed. But it's painful for the sake of being purposeful. It's light which harms, embarrasses, so that it can heal. Because look at the second half of the sentence. Everything exposed by the light becomes visible. Oh my goodness. And everything that is illuminated becomes a light. Do you see how remarkable that is? That there is something about Christ's light shining in that exposes everything, but everything it exposes becomes in and of itself a light. Have you ever heard the story, perhaps, of someone's pretty horrific sin in their past? A sexual indiscretion, a fraudulent use of money, someone clocking another person around the face for no legitimate reason. But there comes a point, perhaps years or even decades later, where that person says, in the grace and goodness of God, that indiscretion has now become a light to others. I can now speak from the pit of sexual indiscretion to those before they trip and fall. And Christ is using that as a light to warn others away. Or I can now speak to others about the grace of God which conquers temper and anger because I've journeyed that and I can encourage. Do you see that when the light of Christ shines, it exposes everything, but everything it lands on, light begets light, becomes a light in and of itself. And so sentence 14 here is quite remarkable. It's remarkable to me personally, as I explained, but I think it's remarkable in and what it's saying. Wake up, O sleeper, rise from the dead, shake your dormant faith awake, grab it by the shoulder and say, come on, time to get up. Where it's laying comatose, practically dead, give your faith a good kicking. Get it up and alive. Because when you do that, Christ will shine on you and you'll become a light. And that's the one all-prevailing yet wisdom-needing application, if you like, that I've got, which is here in the text. Which is that once Christ has shone on you, if that's your experience, or I hope if it's not, it's what you're longing to experience, that exposure that creates light in all aspects of your life, then the one application that Paul has here in sentence 7 to 12 is no longer partner with darkness, but be light to the darkness. No longer partner with darkness, but be light with the darkness. Look at sentence 8. It says, for you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Live as children of the light. You were once darkness, not in the dark, but you were the darkness itself, he says. But now you are not in the light, but you are the light itself. Do you see the care in his language there? That you've become a light. You're not just in Jesus' light. You are now the light, the mini mag light, of which Jesus is that great big one in the back of your posh cars that you can unclip when you have a crash. You get the little one, don't you? You're the little mag light. Be the light. What does that mean? Now we need some brain power. Look at sentence 7. Therefore, do not be partners with darkness. Look at verse 11. Have nothing to do with fruitless deeds of the darkness. Now we have a question, don't we? If we're light, what does it mean not to partner in verse 7? What does it mean to have nothing to do with in verse 11? Especially when you look back at sentences 3 and 4, if you can, and see what he describes as darkness. Because it's the kind of stuff we might shrug our shoulders about. Darkness is a hint of sexual immorality. Not the whole shebang, just a hint. Have nothing to do with it. Or he says in verse 3, impurity or greed. Or verse 4, obscenity, foolish talk or coarse joking. So what does he mean when he says have nothing to do with those who tell those rude jokes? Does he mean that we're meant to create some kind of ghetto that excludes anyone who swears or tells poor taste jokes or is a bit greedy for money? We're meant to create some kind of ghetto in which they are all excluded. Now, I think that's impossible and impractical because I think I'd self-exclude. I think I'd have to kick myself out of that group. So we need to be sophisticated here, don't we, and say, well, what on earth does he mean? The clue is in how he uses the word partner elsewhere in Ephesians. So here in verse 7, it's in the negative, therefore do not partner with darkness. But he uses the exact same word in the positive back in sentence 6 of chapter 3. Flick back if you've got a Bible there. Chapter 3, sentence 6. He's talking about the creation of the church and how a mass diversity of people are created into one body. Look what he says, chapter 3, sentence 6. This mystery of how the church is formed is that through the gospel, the Gentiles are heirs together with Israel. So these two diverse people are brought together, members together of one body, and sharers together in the promise in Christ Jesus. And the phrase sharers together is the identical Greek word as partners that's used in chapter 5, verse 7. And so in the positive, this word means that we are literally bound to or intrinsically linked. We're driven and steered by. That's what it means to become partners as a church, positively. I'm literally your brother. I'm sorry about that. But I am your brother, and you're stuck with me. It's that level of bond. And so in the negative, he means that we are not to have an association with darkness, whatever that means, which means we are intrinsically linked to it, or bound to it, or that we're driven and steered by that connection. Does that make sense? And so review for a moment, if you would, if you just allow your mind to wander personally for a moment yourself. Review for a moment your relationship with men and women around you in whatever context. Men and women who you might say, you might be sitting in this room right now, but you might say exhibit darkness in their sexual conduct or their coarse language or their joking or... Now, are you driven and steered by that relationship? Are you intrinsically linked to that person in such a way that they are affecting and shaping you? Think for a moment about what you watch on television that may or may not be deemed by you, and everyone will have different opinions on this, but deemed as appropriate. How much do you allow what is darkness, potentially, to steer and drive how you function and make decisions? The magazines you read, the images from the magazines that you allow to saturate your mind. Not that it's wrong to read the magazine, but the partnership he's talking about is that you are intrinsically linked to it, that it steers and drives and shapes you. Does that make sense? That it molds you. If you're a parent for a moment, think about the parenting permissions you grant your children. Think about their screen usage. And how much what comes out of the television and into your child, which you as a parent are the guardian of what goes in to your child, how much that is driving and shaping who they are. That's the wrong partnership. Let me give you one very practical example, because technology allows it to be done so easily and cheaply now. We have no TV in our house which has adverts. Technology means it's easy to wipe any advertising away from what your children view. Why? Because for our young, pliable minds of our children, they were being shaped by that advertising. They would come away from the television feeling they had to have all 7 toys they'd seen advertised. Nothing wrong with the advert, but we deemed as parents their partnership with it was driving, shaping them inappropriately. Does that example help in terms of what this is and isn't? So I want to finish. I'm not quite coming into land yet, but I've only got one other thing to say. It will just take a few more minutes to say it. Is how do we get this balance right? Still here in the text. But how can we be effective in and not affected by whatever we deem as darkness? How can we be influencing others but not influenced by others? How can we be in the crowd but not part of the crowd? How can we be normal yet distinct, human and Christian? What I want to do is to give you a prime example briefly, and you'll be able to guess who that is. It's not me. And I will give you a considered framework from the text here. The prime example is, of course, Jesus, who manages this balance. To be in the darkness, but not of the darkness. To be light, but present where darkness is. Because we see in Jesus, if you read those historical accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that he mingled with, he engaged with, he befriended, he authentically shared life with people from an incredible array of backgrounds. He shared his life with a murderer and a racist, a man called Levi, who Jesus gave him a new name. Does anyone know Levi's new name? He renamed him Matthew, and Matthew wrote Matthew's gospel. He was a murderer, known for it, and a racist, and Jesus authentically shared life there. He shared his life with a potential murderer. That's Peter, who lopped off a chap's ear only because he was incompetent with a sword when he was aiming for his head. And Jesus shared life with the darkness that was in Peter that made him want to kill. He shared life with a prostitute. In fact, a prostitute at that point with no desire to change her life. Her name was Mary. He shared life with a very self-righteous religious man called Simon, In fact, Jesus' principles seems to have been to so fully immerse himself in what would have been known as darkness that those around called him dark. Those around him, he was so immersed in it, said Jesus is a drunkard. Jesus is a zealot and a racist. That Jesus is immoral sexually. He wasn't. But there seems to be a principle that Jesus wants us to following him, where we so immerse in the darkness without surrendering to it while remaining light in it, but so immersed in the darkness that people actually think we are dark. They even call Jesus the devil himself because of that. And so there seems to be, from the prime example of Jesus, a biblical principle that when it comes to what we view as confrontational or uncomfortable, we have to have a healthy disrespect for our own reputation. It's what the Bible calls not having a fear of people, of what people will say about us. I think for most Christians, it's not having a fear of what other Christians will say about our associations with those in the darkness. What's the considered framework then of how we stay light while fully immersed in the dark? It's up there on the screen. Third slide, please, John. And for many, many thousands of years, using different words, this has been seen as the Bible's approach to culture. And it's in the passage here as well as many other passages. Some things we're to receive. There are certain things in culture, however dark we might think it, area might be, however light, there are certain things in culture which we can just accept and celebrate and commend in the culture. In verse 9, they're described as the fruit of light, consisting of goodness and righteousness and truth. That there are certain things in any and every culture, in any and every relationship, in any and every human being, which by default are good and light. They're true and they're righteous. And we should celebrate them and accept them. In verse 10, he goes even further and says we should try and find them. He says, and find out what pleases the Lord. He doesn't mean that we lack knowledge about what pleases the Lord. He means that we are to seek out and find what pleases the Lord. Wherever we may be, there will be things which please God, and we're to work hard to identify them and celebrate them. And so the first things when it comes to any situation, any relationship, any television program, is to say, what is here that I can receive? What can I just accept and celebrate and commend already as good? And of course, as soon as we start doing that, it stops us being arrogant, which is a great thing that Christians excel at, is arrogance. We think we only have all the truth and all the goodness. No, it's there in culture. God is already there. Find it, celebrate it, receive it. The second approach is there are certain things that we have to reject. Certain things which we simply say we want nothing to do with. We see that in verse 11 and 12. In verse 11, have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness. Or verse 12, it is shameful even to mention what the disobedient do in secret. So there are certain things, fruitless deeds of verse 11, or the unmentionables of verse 12, that we are simply to reject. Now, we've got to be really clear here. Reject is not the passive turning of a blind eye to something that is horrific. It's not pretending that the horrors are not there. It's not withdrawal or intentional ignorance and saying, I don't want anything to do with that, so as a Christian I'm going to run away. That's not Christian rejection. Christian rejection is quite the opposite. We are like firefighters who run into harm's way. When we see something in culture which is dark, when we see something in culture which is unmentionable, we pursue its demise. We strategically and aggressively seek to decommission it. And so when we see someone is homeless or vulnerably housed in a culture where there is ample resources for that, we don't turn around and walk away, do we? We reject it by saying, I will get rid of homelessness in my area. When we hear, and how complex and emotional this topic is, but when we hear of abortions that occur in our country or in our area, and that is so complicated and emotional, and I'm very aware of that. But it doesn't remove the fact that for many of those babies, their life is ended. A Christian doesn't turn a blind eye just because it is so emotionally and intellectually complex a question, we don't turn away and walk away from it. We walk into it. We pursue answers filled with grace, filled with love, filled with togetherness for those ladies, some of whom will be in this room this morning, who have aborted a child. We seek, though, its demise in the most healthy and positive way when we see horrors that are there. Rejecting does not mean we pretend that there is not sexual slavery in our world, or pretend that there's not domestic violence on our street or behind our front door. We walk into battle to fight for justice. And we see it here. That's what "have nothing to do with" means. It means fight for right. And then lastly, we go into culture to be the light. We receive certain things. That stops us being arrogant. We reject certain things, and that stops us being naive and useless because we're proactive. But thirdly, we can redeem certain things, transform them, change them. Light always wins. Be exactly what Jesus has been to us, which is sentence 13 here. That everything the light, that is you and me now, not just Jesus, everything exposed by the light becomes visible. The horrors are shown. But everything that is illuminated by the light becomes light. That's what it means to redeem. It means to rid the world of what is wrong and then turn it round and see it used for good. Light always wins. So as I finish and put the ball into your court to ponder and think, very clearly, here in God's word, it says, "Wake up, O sleeper, rise from the dead." Where your faith has become dormant, and it will describe all of us to a small extent and some of us to a large extent. Wake up, O sleeper, rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. And what that means is we now get to be light in the dark. And being light means there will be things that we actively receive and celebrate. It means there's things that we will aggressively pursue their demise, which is what reject means. And there'll be most things which, powered by grace and God's Spirit, we can see redeemed and turned to good. So take a moment. I'm going to stand. I'll pray in 20, 30 seconds. Take that time to think. What aspect of my faith needs to be kicked awake? Wake up, O sleeper. And where do I need to more receive? Commend what is good. Stop being arrogant. And commend it's good. It's great in culture. It's marvelous. What do I need to reject? What am I turning a blind eye to that I need to turn round and run into the battle? A soldier for Christ. Into harm's way. And what can I better redeem as light in the dark? Spend a moment or two pondering before I pray.